Welcome to Sabbatical 101. My name is Bethany Walensky, and I'm an associate professor at Michigan State University. I had a life-changing sabbatical, and I'm on a mission to help fellow academics do the same. This podcast is a resource for all things academic sabbaticals. Each episode will provide you with inspiration and insight into the sabbatical planning process, regardless of your institution, discipline, length of sabbatical, or where you plan to sabbatical. I'm so excited to have you along for the ride. I think it's really appropriate that we're kicking off the podcast with this conversation with my former colleague, David Stroop. If you've ever heard me talk about my sabbatical, then you've heard me talk about David, although you might not know his name. David came back from his sabbatical just as I was starting to plan my own, and his sabbatical inspired me to think differently about my sabbatical, and ultimately led me to do a sabbatical in France instead of Tanzania. David had an amazing year-long sabbatical with his wife and daughter in Florence, Italy. You're going to love hearing about it. Great. Hi, David.
Hi, Bethany. It's good to see you.
Good to see you too. I'm so excited to talk with you about your sabbatical. I've been looking forward to this conversation because, as you know, your sabbatical was the inspiration for mine. I've been planning to go to Tanzania for my sabbatical. But I remember when you gave your sabbatical report during a faculty meeting after you came back, I thought to myself, like, I want David's sabbatical.
We tell everyone that everyone should go to Italy. That was my sabbatical. Everyone should go to Italy for a sabbatical. Yep.
Totally. So I didn't go to Italy, so I didn't take the same sabbatical as you. But what happened is your sabbatical really inspired me to think differently about mine. So thank you. And I did think of you when we were in Italy during my sabbatical.
Yeah. For vacations. Excellent. Over a good glass of wine, I hope.
Yes, of course. So just to introduce you a little bit, you're an associate professor of STEM education at the University of Utah, and we were colleagues at MSU, of course. Could you just say like a tiny bit about your research focus so we can kind of situate you in the world?
Yeah, you bet. And we were good colleagues in Michigan State for a long time, and I miss you. You should come visit. So I do sort of three big things. I think about how science teachers and students negotiate science communities and classrooms, and I pull from a lot of history and philosophy of science lenses to do that. I think about how teachers, both pre-service and in-service teachers, learn to do their work. And then I think about me as a teacher educator, and I think about the opportunities that I design for pre-service teachers to like learn how to do equity and justice science teaching.
Okay, great. And so you were at MSU for how many years? And
10 years, so 11 years, 2013 until August 2013 to August 2023.
Okay. And now you've been at Utah for, is it 2 years already?
Or one year, starting second year, 1 year.
Okay. 1 year. Yeah. So today we're talking about your sabbatical, which was your first sabbatical post-tenure, correct?
Yes, correct. Okay.
Great. Yeah. So I want to dive into the sabbatical, but first I know you have a family. And so tell us a little bit about your family because they were obviously implicated and I think willing participants in the sabbatical.
So this is an important thing to talk about. So my wife's also a professor. She's a historian of Mexico and she does a lot of gender studies work. I have an older daughter, Emma, who's currently a senior at Brown and does international policy things. It's very cool. My younger daughter, Zoe, is about to start her first year of college. She does singing and songwriting. But at the time, so I was eligible to go on sabbatical like right after tenure, right? So you put in your tenure stuff and then you get tenure and then you're eligible for sabbatical. At the time, my older daughter, Emma, was a sophomore in high school. And so she told us, we talked about it as a family about whether we wanted to do sabbatical. And Emma at the time asked us not to do sabbatical while she was in high school. And so I was, that's fair. That's a fair request from a 10th grader. Mm-hmm. So I was actually overdue for a sabbatical when we did ours. Overdue, like I could have taken one, but put it off for a few years.
And so when you were thinking about sabbatical, you were thinking about going away for sure, which is why she didn't want you to do it while she was in high school.
Correct. She did not want to go abroad. We were definitely thinking about going abroad. Mm-hmm. Then COVID hit. And so living in, if listeners have not been to East Lansing, Michigan, it's a small college town. It's pretty insulated. And so when sort of COVID was, it was looking like we could travel again. And when we started actually thinking about sabbatical, Emma was by that time was going to go to college. And so we didn't really have to sort of, we worried about, actually that factored into the decision about where we were going to go because we didn't want to be too far away. But Zoe, our younger daughter, who when COVID hit was in eighth grade and then did all of ninth grade online, really wanted to leave East Lansing. She really wanted a break from East Lansing. Okay. And so she wanted to go abroad. So it was like good timing for us to really think about going abroad. Yeah.
Okay.
And then Erin, my wife, could teach remotely. That was what we sort of worked out with Michigan State, was that she could teach remotely. Because they were still COVID made that possible in a way, which was there was a lot of asynchronous online teaching, but there was also like a lot of, you know, synchronous but online instruction. So Michigan State expanded what it thought was possible in terms of online instruction. So that was helpful as well.
Yeah. Okay. Great. So and so your sabbatical, you took a year long sabbatical in Italy was it 2021, 2022?
Yes. Fall. So Zoe and I flew there on August 31st, 2021, and then we returned like mid July 2022, almost a year.
Okay. Great. And I know that there were some twists and turns as you planned it. And so you've given us the background of like, you know, how you work this into your like family situation. But tell the story of how it came to be Italy for the sabbatical, how you landed there.
Yeah, there's like a multi-pronged way. This is maybe the best. I don't know. Everyone probably has a sabbatical story at some point about this. So I initially applied for Fulbright to go to Edinburgh. That's a very long process to apply for, and you don't hear back for a long time. And so we didn't really hear back until April 2021.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you had no idea if you were going to Edinburgh or not.
Right. Until April 2021. Okay, put that in your time. And right by August, we were flying to Italy. Okay, so April 2021, we found out that I didn't get a Fulbright. Around that same time, I was wrapping up an article for a journal that got accepted, and I was emailing with one of the associate editors of the journal who is at the University of Bologna. And we had such a good time. She's a great editor, and so her name is Olivia Lavrini. She's a key figure in the story. So as we were sort of wrapping up the process of getting it accepted, she emailed me and said, Italy's reopening from COVID. And if you ever find yourself in Italy, let me know. And I'd be happy you could come give a talk at the University of Bologna. It would be great. So Italy was on our sort of plan B radar for places we wanted to go if we didn't get the Fulbright. Mm-hmm. We'd been there as a family. Pre-COVID, like 2019, we spent about 3 weeks there as a family. And so then I took that email to Erin and Zoe and said, should we pursue this? Like here, I don't know, there's maybe like a little crack at the door. So sure, let's see if it's even possible. So I wrote Olivia back and said, instead of just giving one talk, what if I actually like came there for a while and did a sabbatical in Italy? And she wrote back almost right away and said, oh my gosh, this is so exciting. The University of Bologna like prides itself on being this global place where we always want to bring scholars in. You would be the first scholar we could bring in post COVID. Hey, let me go. We're going to make this work. We're going to make this work. So we had to wait a couple of days to sort of hear back from her about what could be possible. Mm-hmm. And she wrote us back and said, yes, I talked to my dean and chair, like, we'll piece something together, but it would be really cool if you would be able to spend the year here. That'd be really cool. So we had to scramble a little bit as a family, right? To say, this is, you know, by this point, it's almost the end of April. And wow. So we had to sort of scramble a little bit to figure out what are we going to do? Where are we going to go? And the big decision then became, do we want to live in Bologna? Mm-hmm. Or do we want to look somewhere else? And for us at the time, with a 10th grader, Zoe was going into 10th grade. She knew she was going to do 10th grade in Italy. With a 10th grader, and we looked around Bologna, it's really hard to find housing in Bologna. Learned, okay. Because there's 80,000 undergraduates at the university.
Oh my gosh.
From all over the world. And we are not the people that renters in Italy are looking to rent to. Uh-huh. Because we were going to be there for longer than they wanted to rent for, because they just want to rent to students for a semester for like the academic year. Mm-hmm. We were going to be there for longer. And so we weren't on their mind. Around, as we were thinking about that, we'd been to Florence. We'd spent a couple of days in Florence when we'd gone through Italy. And so we liked Florence, and we noted that there was a high-speed train from Florence to Bologna. It took 30 minutes, which is what I ended up taking because we lived in Florence. We also saw that there were some interesting school options. Mm-hmm. So for Zoe. And so we did some investigating, and we found a school that looked interesting for her. It was a French immersion school. So she spoke mm-hmm. French. And so there was a French immersion school, and that became where we decided to go. And we rented an Airbnb for a month, but in Italy, you're not allowed to rent an Airbnb for more than a month because I think they're trying to cut down on like immigration things. So we went there knowing we would have to find a different place to live for the rest of the year. And so one of the first things we did when we got there was like find a rental agency that eventually helped us find an apartment for the rest of the year. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, yeah, that sounds amazing. The high-speed trains in Italy were very impressive. So yes. I feel like I would have enjoyed that commute. I couldn't believe how nice they were. We went from Venice to Florence and then Florence to Rome. And I was like, I could do this all day. This is amazing.
Yeah. And like a fun fact is, because I know people are probably wondering about like funding stuff too.
Yeah.
So a fun fact is I had a grant. Michigan State paid for half of my salary.
Yep.
And then I had grants cover the other half. So I had some National Science Foundation funded grants. I could get my high-speed train tickets paid for on my grant because it was like for official work stuff. So I just had some travel money. And so then, mm-hmm. I learned you could buy high-speed train tickets in bulk. And so mm-hmm. I just bought, I don't remember how many, but I bought them. And then I could just sort of hop on a train and go back and forth. 30 That's minutes great. Each way. It was nice.
Yeah. So how often did you end up, tell me a little bit about how you thought about your time on sabbatical. So mm-hmm. Did you have a specific project or thing you were working on at University of Bologna, or was it kind of mm-hmm. open-ended?
Yeah, good question. So I did two big things. So one is two and a half big things. One was I had just finished editing a book for Harvard Ed Press that came out in 2020. And right as that book was coming, like about to come out, I got contacted by someone else at Harvard Ed Press who said, it's cool that you have like done all this work. I just read a couple of articles that you read. Have you ever thought about doing a book for teachers, like writing a book specifically for teachers and not academics? Mm. And at first I was like, I don't know, man. I think I need a break from a book. But then once we got the sabbatical ball rolling, I simultaneously knew I like needed a project for Michigan State to approve it, but also had a conversation with this person at Harvard Ed Press. And I appreciated the challenge of taking some of the like philosophical work that I've done for science classrooms and turning it into a book for teachers. So I ended up doing a book in Italy, writing a book for teachers about the work that I do. And fun fact, it won an award. And then like, that's my joke about that is if you want to win a book award, you go write a book in Italy. That's the key.
Well, congratulations. That's and I may take your advice. I had my best, my best half marathon time of the sabbatical year in Nice. And so what I extrapolate from that is clearly I need to be in France in order to run
well.
Right.
Clearly you're a better runner in France. That's
exactly.
right.
Exactly. That's the only logical conclusion.
That's what I hear. Yeah. 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 And I can talk about the balance between book and other things too. The other 1.5 things that I did too was in part of what I worked out with Olivia Leverini at the University of Bologna was, she has a science education group there. So I would go maybe once a week ish. So 3 or 4 times a month up to Bologna, and I would just hang out. I would go to some of their research group meetings. I gave 2 talks a semester. Part of what she wanted to, in her words, like use me, which is fine because she's in a department of physics. And so she wanted to use me, I'm putting air quotes around that, to compel her colleagues to think differently about science teaching and learning. So I would give talks. That's fine. I don't mind being used that way because, you know, I was in Italy. It was great.
Yeah.
I went to, she had some European Union funded grants. So I went to some of those meetings when like the grant people from all over the Europe would come and they would talk about stuff. I would go to those and hang out and listen to see what Europeans were talking about science education, which is very cool. So that's like the half thing. The big other thing that I did there was I helped teach a class. I learned that in Europe, for future science teachers, they took a semester long class. But in Europe, they broke it into modules. So there are 3 different modules within a semester that each had a different instructor. So I taught the second module in their semester with an Italian TA in English. They wanted it taught in English, probably for me, but also because they want the students to speak English because many of them teach at international schools. Okay. And so they wanted to make them more marketable if they wanted to go to Switzerland or France or something. So I had about 2.5 weeks of doing like a fast-forwarded version of what I might do in a semester or a year with method students at Michigan State in English in Bologna. But then I was going every day on the high-speed train.
Okay.
So, like every day. And then those were the longest days. I would show up there like 8:30, 9 a.m. and I'd probably be there till 6 or 7 p.m. just because we were teaching and then planning. But that was the only time where I had to go every day. And that was like late February and into March.
Okay. So it sounds like you had these 3 things or like 2.5 things that you were working on. So one of the things that I've been talking to people a lot about is like, how do you find that sweet spot of how much work you're doing on sabbatical and not being, for many people, by the time you get to sabbatical, or I can speak for myself, I was so burnt out and overwhelmed that I really needed to change my pace and not focus on work so much.
Yep.
Could you talk a little bit about that? You mentioned when we were talking before we started recording that you also use sabbatical as a time to reset. So say a little bit about that balance.
Yeah. I think we probably do ourselves a disservice as professors by not taking sabbatical sooner or more often. And, I was talking with another one of our Michigan State colleagues, Neeral Shah. He's on sabbatical right now. And now he's at the University of Washington. And I sort of described it to him as you don't know how busy you are as a professor until you're not.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you don't know how much you do until you don't do it. And I remember the build up to sabbatical, like maybe the semester before we left. I'm pretty busy and pretty productive as a scholar. And I remember the feeling before leaving. So, like April, May, maybe knowing we were going on sabbatical too, but I just remember feeling like I can't type anymore. I can stare at my computer. I know I need to put in a proposal for conference, but like, I can't physically type. I think my brain is tired.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of why I wanted to work on the book for teachers was that I I needed to say, I wanted to talk to a different audience. And I didn't, you know, we're not always, you know, from doing books, we're not always encouraged as professors in education to write books.
Yeah.
It's not, if you, Aaron, the historian, my wife's a historian, that's what they do, but that's not what we do. And so
yeah, we're not a book field.
We're not a book field. Well, some people are, but like, I'm not.
Yeah.
Science education people, and there's not a book field. So there were actually some people in our department that were discouraging me from doing a book because it wouldn't, whatever. And I think that was my cue that, oh, this is a thing I should do. This is definitely a thing I should do. Like, if, yeah, because I don't care. I'm going to do this book. So I think I liberated myself in some way because I was being a little bit of a rebel and doing something that people were telling me not to do, which ended up winning an award. And that's kind of funny because, like, now it's a thing.
Now they want to take credit for it, right?
Yeah.
And it sounds like even though writing a book is a big project, your reason for writing the book, like, I just want to kind of restate it. It's not like, oh, I have to write this book so I can go up for fall. You were like, I'm writing this book because I want to write this book because it's what I feel like is next. Like, it makes sense for my career. And so it's kind of like a personal goal, too, in addition to a professional one.
For sure. For sure is a personal goal. And I wanted, it felt important that when talking with Harvard Press, it felt important to share the ideas with teachers. It felt important to do that.
Yeah.
And so it was like a fun thing to do. I mean, of course I worked on papers and things as I was going along the year, right? Like, it wasn't like I wasn't doing academic work. But I purposely worked in the morning. I purposely did some typing in the morning, and that was it. Every day my goal was like, I kind of mapped it out, actually. So I knew they gave me an approximate number of, like, we wanted to be about 150 pages or something. And so I kind of mapped out, like, if I work, you know, if I work for an hour or two every morning and I write, a couple paragraphs a page, I don't know, I could send them if I did that starting in September, like when we got there, and I kind of sent them a chapter a month, basically, chapter a month for revisions. By the time I get to like April, I've sent them the book, and then I have a month or two to revise it, and then it's due, and then that'll be it. And so I just said, like, I'm going to write for a couple hours every morning, and then I'm not going to write anymore on the book. Instead, I'm not, after lunch, I'm not doing it. Yeah. And then if I don't do it, I can work on it tomorrow. But it became a really good way to pace myself and say, like, I don't have to finish a chapter a day. I don't have to finish this much a day. I'm going to do whatever I can do in the morning. And then we lived around the corner. Our apartment was around the corner from one of those huge, I don't know if you went to one in Florida, it's like a big open air sort of market, where they had all the fresh food. So we lived around the corner from one, and we would ask Zoe often, you know, before she went to school in the morning, what do you want for dinner? And so she would tell us. And so for lunch, we would go to the market and we would buy food and for dinner. And then we might grab lunch there. We might bring something back to our apartment. And once I like physically left the apartment to go to the market, then I didn't have to think about work. I could put the book away and I could say, like, I'm in Florence, Italy. I'm going to go get some food and it's going to be great. So we would have lunch and then maybe we send a few emails or something for an hour. And then often we would go on a walk.
Yeah.
We had a dog, as you might ask about. We took our dog with us. So we would take our dog on a walk around the city. And they, in Italy, as you saw, they have water fountains everywhere. There's like public water fountains. So our dog memorized where all the water fountains were because he would want to drink out of them. And so we would got to know the city really well. We would go exploring around. We would just walk around the city. And then we would try and be back when Zoe got home from school. We would hang out some, and she would have homework, but we would hang out some, and we would cook dinner. And then I'm a nighttime runner. And so I would go running along the Arno River in Florence in the evening. And then I'd come back and then I might do some work, you know, some email or some academic-y things. But by then, because I hadn't been doing it all day, I was like kind of ready to do it. That was nice. The other big, so that was like the actual work I did. The other big thing that the advice, especially I got from my PhD advisor, was as you mentioned, like, you're going to get a lot of offers to do stuff, as we always do, serve on an NSF panel virtually, review this article, be part of this conversation. And the advice was, you just know, just say no to everything. Don't review
categorically.
Basically a categorical no, like don't review anything. Don't agree to this meeting. Remove yourself from all committee work that's possible for you to do. Only committee work that I did was that I was asked to be on the AERA wide practice-based teacher or practice, like research practice award for the entire organization. I was like, well, okay, I should probably say yes to that. But that was it. That was it. That was the only thing I did. Was I didn't review anything. I learned that you can go into journal websites and you can say when you're not available. So I just blocked off like August 1st, 2021 through August 15th. I was over a year, August 15th, 2022. I'm not available.
Yeah.
And I got emails from good friends of mine who are associate editors of journals. And they would say, like, good, like, who had a conference? We'll go have dinner, right? Like, good friends of mine.
Yeah.
And they would say, oh, I know you say you're unavailable, but like, could you just do this? And no, right. It was really hard. I'm like, no, I hate saying this to you, but like, no, I have this principle. Like, I'm not going to do it. And it was,
wonderful.
It was really wonderful just to not review anything.
Well, and I think it's really freeing to set that boundary and then just say, no matter what comes in, no matter who it is, no matter what it is, I'm just going to say no. And I think sometimes we get motivated by like a perception of scarcity or, oh, this could be something that really changes my career. Yeah. Or it's like, no, we know we've been doing this long enough that these opportunities are going to come around again. And there's always going to be another paper to review, another committee to be on. And I think also, like you just described this really kind of lovely shift in your daily routine. And if you had said yes to journal reviews, suddenly you're like, oh, I got to run back from, you know, the market to, you know, where I can't go on a walk today because I'm trying to review this article. And so sometimes at least I'll speak for myself, I always underestimate how long things are going to take. So you're like, oh, if I just say yes to this one thing, it won't be that big of a deal. Right. But then you kind of open the floodgates and then there goes your sabbatical.
Right. My classic example too was I got asked to be, in science education, you get asked to be on review panels for the National Science Foundation for grants. That's like, it's great. And I try and do it, but I got asked to be on one of those virtually. And I said like, no, and I always try and do them because I have NSF money and I don't, it's nice to keep that relationship. And I worried for one second about like, oh, are they going to be mad at me? And then what happened the next year? I got asked again. Right. So, and guess what? Grants got funded without me being on the panel. So,
It wasn't quid pro quo.
totally fine.
Yeah. So something else that happened to you on your sabbatical is you got a new job. You interviewed for jobs. So you were busy in lots of ways. Tell me a little bit about, you don't have to get into every specific detail of the process, but just like, what did you learn about like making a transition coming like in a sabbatical year and then coming off of a sabbatical year?
Yeah. I think the most interesting thing we noticed was when you take a step back on sabbatical, so you physically leave the university where you are and you go somewhere else, then you're not there. You're not hearing the sort of drama. And every university has drama, right? Like, let's not pretend like every place is, there's not like a perfect place. Every place has something. But when you're removed from the university that's granted you the sabbatical, then you can kind of take a step back and because you're not living in it, the students aren't there, your colleagues aren't there. I care deeply about the students, of course, but I like wasn't there to hear sort of all the things going on. Then you get to walk around into the open air market, right? And you start asking questions about priorities and you start asking questions about, do I need to be at a specific place to do the work I want to do? Or by the time you get sabbatical, you probably have tenure and you're probably established in some way in your field. is my identity tied to a place, or like, am I a scholar of these things that I do, and could I do that work anywhere? And am I tied to a place? So, of course, we start asking those questions of ourselves as we're walking around in Florence, Italy. And then I got contacted by, as we all do, probably by the time you get tenure, like you start getting contacted by people and saying, hey, we have this position. Would you be interested, or do you know anyone? So there were a couple that seemed interesting to us in ways, mm-hmm. in part because of where we were in our careers. And so we ended up moving to the University of Utah, which is where we are now. And I think the biggest thing to navigate was every university might have a different policy, but Michigan State's policy was either when your sabbatical ends, either you have to come back for a year, mm-hmm. When sabbatical is over, to like, because you were gone for a year, so you like owe us a year of stuff. Or we learned that if you get a new job, if the new job will pay for your salary for the year, then you can just go there.
They pay MSU off so that you can go.
I like soccer. I'm a big soccer fan. And so it's like a transfer fee, right? Like, yeah. we'll buy out you from your contract or whatever, that they can just come right away. So I personally think that for good reason, Utah was not willing to buy me out. Like, that's would have been money. But also I needed a transition year. I think it was actually really helpful. Everybody knew that I was leaving, mm-hmm. at the end of that year, students included. And so it was a good off-ramp. I think it would have been really jarring to have I came back from sabbatical, I'm going to pack up my office and go.
Yeah.
I think that would have been really jarring. And for me and for like students especially.
Sure.
So in college, like I still have ongoing research projects. I still have NSF grants at Michigan State. So it would have been really jarring for colleagues as well. So it gave us a nice off-ramp, both in terms of like, I can help out for the year. Like, we can, you know, we can do the things we need to do, but also now we can make a plan, mm-hmm. for further years. So, you know, I had students, like I had a student who, I was his advisor, and he didn't want to come to Utah. He wanted to stay in Michigan State. Totally fine. Mm-hmm. So we came up with a transition plan to have a different advisor. I'm still in his dissertation committee, right? But like, it was possible for us to come up with this plan of transition, in a way that would have been really hard had I just gone right away.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And I think, I find it so, it's funny that we kind of both earn a sabbatical and then have to pay it back, but that's a different conversation for a different day, but I could see I appreciate how you I think one of the benefits to being able to go abroad for your sabbatical, and I know that that's not the case for everyone, but I can identify with that. It just gives you a different perspective on, you know, your life, your priorities. And I think you're right. Kind of, even if you're, I guess a way that you could approximate that, if you're unable to go away for your sabbatical, is just being away from your institution as much as you can to kind of see it with fresh eyes or see new possibilities. Not that everyone needs to change their job, but just kind of, you know, to make sure you're in the place that's best for you and your people.
The nice part, I mean, if you're not able to go abroad, the other thing that we did in Italy, but that anybody could do anywhere too, is for funny visa reasons, which we can talk about if you want to, but like for funny visa reasons, Aaron and Zoe were in limbo for a lot of the year, mm-hmm. in terms of a family visa. So we basically couldn't leave Italy. They couldn't leave Italy. I could, but they couldn't. So fine, we'll just take a train somewhere every weekend. We went somewhere every weekend. We just went to a new town and just explored. And I feel like even if you can't go abroad on sabbatical, you could hop in your car or get on a bus or something and just go with your family if you wanted to, just to a different town, just to look around on a weekend. Because if you're not reviewing, if you're not doing whatever, just go hang out. Like, we had a great time just sort of hanging out and seeing stuff. And then, that was hugely important for us, was as wonderful as Florence was, because it was, but just getting out and seeing other things too. And that was really nice.
Yeah. And taking advantage of, I mean, being, even if you're staying within Italy, just like the amount of things you can do, just hopping on the train. It's
with our dog often with our dog, because you can take your dog on a train in Italy.
It's amazing.
Buy a ticket for your dog.
Oh, they need a ticket. Okay.
They do need a ticket, but it's cheaper. And but you, we all the time you go on trains and there's a bunch of dogs.
Cool. So looking back on your sabbatical, if you had to say, like, I mean, it sounds like it was so amazing. There were so many great parts of it. What were kind of the highlights, or what do you think went really well about it?
Yeah. One was we really enjoyed being, if you can go abroad, we really enjoyed being away from America. It was just nice. This was, you know, 2021, 2022, right? So post Trump, post COVID, you know, those were hard 4 years. Yes. And it was really nice to be away for a year. It was just really nice. So if you
disengage.
Yes. If you can go abroad, it's nice to get other perspectives on things. So that was one. Another one was I was really glad to have it be fully funded between half my salary at Michigan State and then having grants to do the other half, and getting, you know, getting paid some to do work at Bologna, like getting stuff on top of it. It was really nice not to have to teach at your university online to cover some sort of salary, right? Like it was nice to have the freedom to do the things we wanted to do without having to worry about or scramble and are we going to be able to afford it. So we rented our house out. We kept our house in Michigan, and then we rented it to a postdoc, which is also really helpful. And then the other, I think the other big important thing was we were really flexible as a family about what we wanted to do. And so we gave Zoe, especially school for Zoe was hard in a lot of ways. And so we really wanted to make sure that we listened to her about what she wanted to do on sabbatical. Where do you want to go? What are some food you want to eat? Like, we gave her a lot of voice in what she could have a voice in. And that was really great too, because then our flexibility allowed us to like do a lot of fun things that if we had been like, no, you got to do this, I think that would have been hard. So, so those, that was really helpful.
And so how did sabbatical go for Zoe? Because I know sometimes, you know, it depends on the kid. Like you said, Emma didn't want to go on sabbatical when she was in 10th grade, but Zoe did. So what was her experience like?
It was simultaneously good and simultaneously hard. School was hard. You were just in France on your sabbatical, and we did not know a thing about French pedagogy, which is it's different in like really, I would say, like malicious ways. And as someone who studies and works with teachers, it was very hard to watch your kid go to a school where she was initially excited to go, and then the teachers are just like cruel. They're like cruel. And there's a lot of like public shaming about stuff. And eventually we had to start going to school to sort of talk with the faculty about like, could you not do this? Could you say something nice? And they would be very confused and would say, but that's not French. That's not the French way. Like the French way is we kind of make fun of you until you get it. So that was hard. Yeah. That was hard. That was an unexpected hardship. What was nice was most days of the week, she would get a 2-hour lunch break. There was also like an espresso break in the morning. And so there was like a cafe across the street where they would go get an espresso. But there was also often a lunch break. And so we would give her, you know, here's 15 euros, go off. And so she made two good friends there who were also not from Italy. It was an international school, but it was a French school. Okay. So they would go wander the streets of Florence, Italy at age 16. And I mean, that was what an amazing experience. So when people would come visit us, they would say, what's a good gelato place? What's a good panini place? And Aaron and I would have our answers, whatever. But we would say, you got to ask Zoe, because she's gone all over this town.
She knows all the things. Yeah.
And it was cool. I think it was cool to be like, I'm the person who knows the most about Florence, right? Like, I mean, Aaron and I did too, but it was cool for her to have that. being a singer or songwriter also, she will say that it was a really good, hard experience that has given her a lot of inspiration for her art. So that's been, it's like, you know, kind of the blessing and a curse of the artist is you have hard experiences, but then you can turn them into something really positive. So yeah, I don't know that she personally would pick Florence again, but I think she got a lot out of it. The other big thing that we enjoyed was leaving for her, especially going on weekends to other places. And then we had a lot of fun sort of exploring around. Emma, our older daughter, came twice. So she came during her winter break, which for her college was almost a month. And then she came when her semester ended for about 3 weeks. And we saved big trips. So we would go kind of close-ish by, like we could take a train and stuff. But when Emma came, we did big trips. So we went to Lake Como, which is in northern Italy, because she wanted to go there. Super nice. We did not see George Clooney. That's the question. We did not see George we probably saw his house, though. We went there. And then when she came over winter break, we and Aaron's mom and stepdad came as well. We went south. We went to Pompeii. We went to like, we went south. So we had two big trips when she came. And that's when we were able to sort of go a little bit further away. We did go one big trip was that we went to Sicily and around for her, a break that she had. So that was fun. We tried to get out and do stuff there.
I think, I mean, so you're, the stuff about school resonates. Like, I can't tell you how many mornings we were dragging Clara, who was in kindergarten, kicking and screaming out of the apartment because she didn't want to put her shoes on and go to school. And then in the last, and they were at a bilingual school, so it was very much not a traditional French school, but they, towards the end, she said, "Can I just go to school in the morning and you pick me up for the French part? I just want to go to the English part." I was like, well, no, we're kind of going to the full day, but yeah, it's challenging. But I think what my husband, what Daniel kept saying is like, whenever we were in those moments, he said, this trip is going to age well. Like it's going, we're all going to remember it really fondly. And I think like, and I think ultimately like all, you know, you have ups and downs even with your kids, even when you're at home, right? But even the stress that it put on them and the family, we all came through in the end having learned some things and everyone, you know, now can't wait to go back to Bordeaux. So
The flip side of that too is we know because she asked to go, right? Like we know that had we stayed in East Lansing, it would have been really hard. It would have been really hard. Like we needed to go somewhere. So it was, that was very helpful.
Yeah. So before we wrap up, I'm curious, is there anything, so I assume you'll have another sabbatical at some point. Anything you do differently on your next sabbatical
or a
goal you have for the next one?
One would be to try not to scramble as fast as we had to scramble to get a visa to go.
It was
a little bit fast forwarded. And Italy, so our other sort of funny story is like Italy bureaucracy is slow. It's just slow. It's not Germany or that was the joke. But the University of Bologna had someone who their full-time job was to help international people with visa stuff because they have so many students and faculty. So he would joke with us that like, if you wanted efficiency, you should have gone to Sweden or Germany, but instead you picked Italy. So the bureaucracy was like a little slow and the European soccer championships were happening and Italy was doing really well. They ended up winning the European soccer championships that summer that we were trying to get a visa. And so, you know, you couldn't call on a game day because
everyone was watching soccer.
You couldn't call on a game day. So it was I think we would commit to a place sooner.
Okay.
Although it would have been, you know, we tried to commit, but we would commit to a place sooner and work on the visa to have a like easier visa process for sure. That would be one thing. Another thing would be it was wonderful to be in a, and like, I think we would commit to this again. It was wonderful to be in a city that had access to transportation out. So we had a lot of affordances being in a city because we didn't have to worry about groceries or what. There was like a lot to do in Florence. And then when we needed to go out, it was much easier to go out and you could look at all the people sort of streaming into Florence, but you were on your way out on the weekend. So it was nice to have that. And then, I mean, we joke with people, but this is real. Like, we part of why we went to Italy was for the food.
Yeah.
I mean, why wouldn't you have go to a place with good food, right? So yeah, I think totally. For our next, oh yeah, we've started to think about, I mean, we haven't seriously thought about it, but we know another sabbatical is on the horizon at some point. And mm-hmm. I think we've got a place with good food for sure. Yeah.
I would highly recommend France, and the visa situation yes. was much easier to navigate. I will okay. tell you that.
Excellent.
That's actually why a big part of the reason we went to France is we could get like a long stay tourist visa before okay. we went.
Yeah.
It wasn't simple, but we could do yeah. it. We just had to go to Chicago for an interview. So
yes, right. We because it was COVID, probably more complicated because things were so closed for us for COVID.
I bet.
So
yeah.
We had to send our passports to Detroit, which was the closest Italian consulate. And then okay. we had to have like a conversation with them. We had to find someone who would translate all of our things, and they wanted a marriage certificate and stuff, and we had to pay someone
to translate it into Italian.
Yeah. This whole thing.
Yeah, that's with France, you also don't have to translate anything. So we were looking at Spain. Same issue with translating. Damn. France, you can submit everything in English. So, yeah. But these are all, yeah, these are realities. And this is why it's so, yeah. I mean, I'm so impressed that you were able to find that out, like make the decision at the end of April and go in August. Like yeah. that's well, amazing.
Yeah. I mean, the huge piece of advice that we have is like, also when you're, if you've sort of committed to a country or you think you're committing to a country, that's when, you know, like contact a faculty member and mm-hmm. as early as you can and just sort of see what's possible. Cause I had actually had like an official appointment. I was like a visiting scholar. Mm-hmm. So I had an okay. office space, like I had official things and they can help you navigate that. But again, Bologna had someone who helped us do visa stuff. And I know Michigan State has an office of that. I learned. So hopefully if you like commit to a place, they mm-hmm. can help you get gears turning on other things. Which there's, if we had to do that on our own, there's no way we could have figured that out.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, well, David, it's been so fun. I feel like we could keep talking for another hour because I have so many more questions, but I know you have things to do.
We can do a part two.
We can do a part two. Yeah, I really appreciated it. Really enjoyed learning more about your sabbatical, and it sounds amazing. And I can't wait for you for your next one. I bet it's going to be.
I know, me too.
Even better.
Me too. I'm excited for my next one too. Thanks, Beth. It's good to see you. It's good to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks so much, David. I hope you found this episode of Sabbatical 101 helpful and inspirational as you think about your own sabbatical. If you want to read more about sabbaticals or get even more support for planning your own life-changing sabbatical, head over to my website, www.bethanywalinsky.com, to read my blog and for more information about my sabbatical coaching program.